Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Joining us live in studio, Steve McMartin, professor at Madai College, former Homeland Security agent, to assess what exactly happened, not just this week, but over the past couple of weeks. Steve, thank you for coming in this morning.
Sure.
This is something we have unfortunately talked about far too many times. And I'm wondering what you're seeing over the past 2 weeks, week and a half, and then maybe expanding that upon previous instances, previous shootings. What are the common threads that connect these events?
Well, do you want to know the common threads involved with the shooters, the common threads that occur after the incidents?
With the shooters before, you know, something that as a law enforcement agent, you can begin to look at and say, okay, these are the things we need to look out for.
Yeah. I think in many of the instances, one thing to look at is the security of the organization or the school that was attacked. What was it like? You know, was there someone inside? Was there an armed presence? Was there a resource officer type person? Were the doors locked? What was the security for visitors, et cetera? That needs to be examined. And, you know, when you look at the shooters, you have a lot of things in common. I think the governor last night did a presentation or a speech. She said, look, there's three things in common. They're all young men under 18, and they're using rifles. So I think these are all things that need to be examined as we go forward.
You know, the 2 days out now, we're starting to kind of get a sense of how this played out. And I can't get out of my mind that this gunman was in that school for 40 minutes at least. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I have not seen that part of the timeline. I can see that it's possible it happened. There is still, since, and even before Columbine, there were issues. I remember there was a shooting at a McDonald's in the early 80s where police waited almost 2 hours to respond. By the time they get inside, everyone was dead, and the gunman had shot himself, you know, many minutes before they entered. I don't know what the situation is in Uvalde. I can imagine if it's like some of the southern small towns I've worked in, the police were quite a distance. It would take a long time for them to respond initially. When did they get the call? It's interesting that the Customs and Border Protection team got there before local police, which just leads me to believe that it was a very rural area and took the police a long time to respond. If the gunman was inside 40 minutes while there was a police presence, that's something that needs to be examined. That's not what protocol is these days.
This raises, I mean, a lot of questions, both what happened here this week, what happened in Buffalo about, you know, the security presence on scene. Both of these cases, we'll start here in Buffalo. I mean, that security guard did everything he was supposed to do and everything that you would expect an armed security guard to do. And while he was able to slow down the attacker, ultimately the armor that the attacker was wearing wasn't able to stop him. A whole other host of questions in this school in Texas as to what exactly they were doing. But, you know, for so many people who have for years said, well, you know, we just need an officer in school, a good guy with a gun. I mean, this is kind of flying in the face of that.
Yeah, so two interesting points. A good guy with a gun, but before addressing that is kind of the security in general. We had the incident in Buffalo. It was in the news, and people thought about it, and there was no hue and cry, and there should have been, about increased security at organizations because it was a TOPS. It was not a school. After the school shooting, now we're going to increase security in schools. Buffalo Police is going to be a bigger presence. We're going to do this. We're going to do that because it was a school. But I have been saying in these interviews for years that organizations, churches, school, whether you're a church or business or whatever, need to look at these instances and plan for them. One, now we go to one man with a gun. Is one man with a gun enough? And clearly we see that in some cases it's not. There needs to be more of a plan and maybe in certain places more of a presence.
We're looking at the shootings that took place over the last 2 weeks with Steve McMartin, former Homeland Security agent, professor at Medina College, who's joining us live in studio. And looking at these events, Steve, we were talking about security, security plans, the security guards, and you were mentioning having plans or something, some sort of security measure in place. And you know, it's a message you've been spreading for a number of years. I also understand the pushback, though. You talk about a church. You talk about a school. Mm-hmm. There is a very good reason why they want to keep open doors, why they want to keep kind of this welcoming atmosphere and not scare people off or something like that with an armed presence. How do you weigh those concerns when you're talking to somebody who's thinking about security?
I think you weigh those concerns by considering the practical matter at hand. I've done talks for community groups and community service groups and high schools and organizations, and generally it's after these talks somebody will pull me aside and say, you know, I'm involved with the security committee, and what do you think we should do? Well, before I tell them, they know what I'm going to tell them. They know what the answer is, and they don't want to hear it. And I tell them they need security procedures. They need to consider locking their doors. They need to consider practicing drills. They need to consider an armed presence. They need to consider whether that armed presence should be, you know, open or concealed. And as soon as I tell them, they say thank you, and they walk away. And I'm sure most people haven't, you know, taken any further steps because they knew what the answer was, and they didn't want to hear it. Well, now they're seeing that they're going to need to do something. And I also couch this whole opinion or thought of mine in this way. This shouldn't be. This wasn't, when I grew up, it wasn't like this. When you grew up, it wasn't like this. It is like this today. I hope it's not like this 6 months from now. It will be. I hope it's not like this a year from now or 2 years from now. Right now, that's the reality, and that's what we need to deal with. And we need to work our way towards a reality that doesn't include this type of issue.
You know, I was talking to a teacher yesterday who said that, you know, now in a classroom, whenever she goes in, she's looking for the exits. She's observing things that she's never observed before. That's the reality today.
Good for her. And you've heard me say that here for 5 years or more, involved when we would be talking about the possibility of a terrorist attack and what to do if you were involved. That's good for her, but she's one out of 100, one out of, you know, 500 or 1,000. People need to start looking at that. Churches, yeah, I'm sorry, churches need to start looking. There was a church shooting, I believe 2 years ago, somebody went in, the Dylan Roof shooting, I believe, and shot all sorts of people. It was a terrible tragedy. But very soon thereafter, there was a church shooting where only one or two people were shot, and two of the congregation members were able to take out the shooter. Now, there was no practice and no preparation, but that shows what practice and preparation could do in the case of something like that happening. And too many places are yet still ignoring. Hue and cry, after Uvalde to increase school security and do this and do that. There was nothing after Tops. It was only 8 days or 10 days prior. And the problem with this is, look back, there's a pattern at everything that happened. Everybody gets all ramped up and says, we're going to do this, we're going to increase security, and we're going to do these things. And then it falls off, and we don't hear about it until the next mass shooting.
Steve McMartin, our in-studio guest, professor at Medina College, former Homeland Security agent, talking about these shootings, how to best prevent them, what to do going forward. Steve, we talked about common threads in between not just what happened in the past week and a half, but what's happened for years. Young men, typically, with a kind of a history of, we'll call it isolation, social alienation. These kind of things that, you know, after a shooting takes place, we point to mental illness, right? It is kind of the obvious thing that hits in most people's minds. But before the event takes place, we don't categorize it as mental illness. It is not classical mental illness as would be defined by a lot of mental health professionals. It's maybe something different, but it's still something that can be spotted, right?
I think, again, I'm not a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, but there are traits. In this case, I believe they're finding he abused animals and posted videos of it. Come on. You know, I assume, not a doctor, that's a classical trait or a sign that a person is suffering some sort of mental illness or descent into what is mental illness, and there probably should be care. No one apparently brought that to the attention of authorities. Had they, what type of care would they have received? I believe everybody wants to jump on guns at this moment and say, oh, guns are the problem. No, I agree. I think they're part of the problem. But I think the way society today treats mental illness is another part of the problem. I think in the past that may have been identified and treated or approached for treatment in a more aggressive manner than it is today.
Or it's just new, right? In the past, you didn't have these places on the internet that you could sit in front of your computer for hours and hours doing. You didn't have social media that's replacing face-to-face interaction.
We've seen this in the area of the proliferation of child abuse and child pornography. We've seen it in the area of radicalization and terrorism, and we're seeing it in the area now of these young men who are doing mass shootings. It's a component of having the time alone, having the access to information, the greater access to information, and the reinforcement of a like-minded community that they're able to find somewhere on the web or the dark web to tell them, yeah, this is okay. Yes, you know, that's what I would do. I would go do this. And then it causes them to go out and do it. But there have to be other hints to people that know these people that this type of descent is going on, that this type of change in mental, you know, stability or mental ability of these people is happening, and it's not being made. In too many cases I've gone later and people have gone, oh yeah, I knew that was happening. You knew it was happening, but you didn't say anything.
They just distance themselves
right
from that. You know, how much is COVID responsible for this too? Because of that lockdown period, all that isolation, and now, you know, that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You want to think that, okay, since it caused these people to be inside, you know, they then retreated to the computer and to the dark areas of the web that they're living in. But I think, whether or not COVID was there or not, those people were going to be inside. They were going to be alone. They were socially awkward. They were, separated from society, and I think probably would have been involved with this type of thing anyway. So, was COVID, did it exaggerate it? Maybe in some cases, you know, probably, but.
I feel like every person, you know, if they're really honest with themselves, they can point to somebody, you know, to a person who they're thinking that about. You know, we're having this conversation. And I feel like most people listening to us right now have somebody in their mind. It kind of goes to show the widespread problem that there is. You know, again, everybody doesn't have somebody in their mind who is going to say, that person needs to be checked into a hospital. But everybody has somebody who they can point to and says, you know, that person's maybe a little off, maybe doesn't get a lot of attention and is, you know, just a little different in that way.
I'm not a mental health professional, but I liken this to interventions in the case of alcoholism. Not everybody knows somebody that's an alcoholic and they need to intervene in their life, but some people do, and some people suspect that they do. And the problem is, I think, when they come to the point of saying, you know, I need to do this, they can't bring themselves to do it. It's a family member, or it's whatever, or there's a cost involved. I just can't do it. And that's the point where, in these cases, when people see this, when people recognize that maybe something isn't right with this individual, there's that hesitation and that reluctance to come forward and to do anything. And somehow in society, we have to get over that.
You know, the other thing too, where do people go? If you say, oh, this person is a little off. You can't call your local police department, right? And say that?
Well, you can. The question is, you know, what will be their response? And there is the societal issue, the cultural issue that we need to deal with, where we're lacking. We don't have the infrastructure set up to deal with these types of things. And I think this is where mental health agencies and mental health professionals have to become involved with this situation and come up with some sort of structure that's able to better deal with this.
Maybe call the person, ask them how their day is. You know, it could be as simple as that.
Dr. Steve McMartin is in studio with us this morning, professor from Madai University, former Homeland Security agent. I want to ask you this because of all of your roles. You were a firearm instructor, Homeland Security agent, now you're professor. Is there such a thing as common sense gun reform?
Well, you know, that's a tough question. My personal stance in this is that we have a lot of gun laws, and they're not enforced properly. And I think it's because the myriad of laws, the mixture of different agencies that have authority on those laws. Take the Buffalo shooter. He had been referred for some sort of mental counseling. He had made a threat to a school. He should have been red flagged. There should have been something in his background that kept him from getting that rifle. So is that a common sense reform of gun laws? It's not. The laws are there. It was a failure of the system to work. So if you want to say common sense reform of gun laws involves a common sense of getting the system to work like it's designed to, maybe taking out some of the superfluous and the dead ends and making sure everything is working, yes, there is a common sense approach to making this better.
In a way, though, we are talking about other laws, and we are talking about an expansion of gun laws because, you know, you mentioned the shooter here in Buffalo went in for a mental health evaluation. You know, an evaluation doesn't rise to the level of giving somebody a red flag if it checks out at the end. You know, that wouldn't have, you know, resulted in anyone saying, no, you can't purchase this firearm. So in a way, we would be talking about some sort of expansion of that. If that were to be, you know, hey, we'll say if you go in for just an evaluation, that would result in the red flag.
Yeah, I personally, I'm against expansion in any area. I'm against expansion of creating a law that calls someone a terrorist because they commit an act that's already a crime. If it's already a crime, you know, why a specialized law? Simply to punish them more, to add a longer punishment at the end? In the case where you're talking, what we need is reform. That person, well, I don't know what the evaluation of the person found, but my information is he made a threat to a school when he was 16 years old. He shouldn't have been able to buy a rifle at 18. Should he be precluded from buying a rifle at 25 or 30 or 35? No, maybe not. And the problem is we don't have anything in place to deal with that type of consideration.
Should an 18-year-old be allowed to buy a rifle like this?
Well, that's great. I saw the governor last night say, I'm going to raise for 21. Well, first of all, what's the difference between 18 and 21? I can tell you, sitting here at 66 years old, I was no more mature at 21 than I was at 18. I don't know what the difference is. And then you're going to have the argument, and you have to give it some credence, that we send young people off to war at 18 years old, but now we're going to restrict their right to buy a gun or buy alcohol or buy, you know. So it's tough to put an age on this. If you want to make it 21, I think you have to make other things 21. You have to look at this and be fair. If you look at it the other way, we're giving children at 16 years old a license to drive vehicles that weigh a ton or 2 tons on highways at speeds that are incredibly crazy. And a vehicle can be used, as we've seen in France and many other places, as a weapon just as effectively as a vehicle.
But it also could be used as a vehicle.
It's a complicated, and a weapon can be used for recreational purposes, just as well.
But if it were 21,
yep,
the shooter here in Buffalo would not be able to walk into the store and buy it.
If it was a federal, if the federal law was 21, that's true. Yeah. But I ask you, what's the difference between 18 and 21?
Well, in this case,
somebody that's threatened to school at 16 years old be allowed to do it at all?
In this case, we wouldn't know. But there are two 18-year-old shooters. I mean, if you're raising the age even a little bit,
right,
say that stops these two things from happening.
Well, yeah, my argument is it wouldn't. What's the difference between 18 and 21?
You're just saying it would put it off.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can make another argument, an anti-gun argument that says, well, raise the age 21, they'd have just found an illegal way to get a gun. Well, that's probably true.
Steve McMartin is our guest, professor at Madai University, former Homeland Security agent. You know, Steve, we're all processing, dealing with these traumatic events, horrible events in Buffalo and Texas. What can someone do when they find themselves in a situation like this?
So active shooter training, as long as some of it takes sometimes, comes down to three things. You can shelter in place, which means to hide. You can run, or you can fight back. Fight back is always the last option. You don't ever want to do that first. The other two are situationally dependent. For example, in the grocery store, as soon as that individual started to shoot, the choice should have been to run. And, of course, then the question comes, where do you run? Well, you can't run out the front door because that's where the shooter's coming in. So initially you have to run towards the back door. The situation compounds itself if there's a second shooter. You know, what happens? Well, then your choice may be to hide or to shelter into place. And although that sounds complicated, and as I said, it's situationally dependent, it's something that people need to take just 5 seconds to think about when they walk into a store. Should you have to think when you go to Tops, what door do I run to? If something happened, you shouldn't. But that's the way, that's the practical situation that we find ourselves in today. Just think about that one time. If you're in a mall and you're walking with your kids, your arms are full of packages and you're pushing a stroller, and 50 feet ahead of you, you hear gunshots, which is unmistakable sound. Do you stop? Do you go into the store that's next to you? Or do you run backwards? Do you leave the packages, take the child out of the stroller and run away? Or do you try to run back with all the packages in the stroller? Most people would keep the packages, keep the stroller, and then try to make some sort of decision. So it's just something that people have to think about just for a few seconds in every situation that they're in.
It's, I was talking with former Buffalo Police Captain Jeff Rinaldo in studio here earlier this week, and he kind of likened it. You made the same comparison to, a fire drill of sorts. And, using it in a way where what you're saying, nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to go anywhere thinking of that in the top of your mind. His argument was, well, no one goes anywhere thinking that a fire is going to break out.
Right.
It's just kind of embedded in your mind somewhere. Everyone just instinctively almost knows what to do because of past training.
Yeah, there's no likening it to that. In that case, I'm sure he was making the same statement that I am, that it needs to be done. Fire drills happen. It's mandated by law that a certain amount of fire drills have to happen in a school every so often. Businesses have them. Even a Home Depot, there's a map on a wall somewhere that shows the fire evacuation and escape routes in case of a fire. Whether or not they practice it or not, I don't know. These drills need to be put in place, and they need to be practiced. Because the problem is, for most people, for most regular civilians, and when an emergency happens, when bang, something starts right at this moment, the first reaction is to freeze. And then, if you have had training, the next thing that will take over is the memory, muscle memory and you know, information memory from that training. If that training has been to turn around and run to the back door, that training may just save your life at some point. These things have to be instituted in schools, in churches, in organizations, and hopefully we won't have to do it 5 years from now, but right now it's the reality.
And as inconvenienced as people are with these things,
well, you know, inconvenience, yeah. How many times are you inconvenienced by a fire drill in a school? Twice in a year? Three times a year? When I worked for Homeland Security, we had an office in a private building, and we had drills where we had to evacuate the building and meet in safe spots outside, and we did it twice a year. We were law enforcement professionals trained in this type of yet we still participated. We still had to do the drills. Were we inconvenienced? Yes. But could it have saved lives at some point? Yes, maybe.
When something like this happens, you know, from your experience, what happens with the information uncovered in the investigation? Because I'd imagine it's more than just figuring out what happened in that moment. You're trying to prevent this from happening in the future. How is that spread out to, you know, law enforcement agencies around the country?
Well, I think the information is spread out fairly well. There's a good intelligence network, law enforcement professionals. There's a good intelligence network for information sharing. But I think the institution of improvements is always on a local and a specific basis. And whether or not those improvements are instituted becomes kind of like an administrative call, a policy call, a legal call. And I know for a fact that a lot of times these things start to filter and fall through the cracks, and they're not addressed again until the next emergency happens.
Well, you're former Homeland Security. How is the internet, you know, this humongous thing, billions of different posts of people saying things and all corners of it. How is that monitored for threats? That's always the question people have. You know, this, how is this not caught? I'm thinking, how do you even begin to track it down?
Yeah. The people today, right now, are saying law enforcement should be on the internet and should catch these people before it happens. And I'm here to tell you, and I think probably any other expert you've had in here will tell you, it can't be done. At this moment, it can't be done. The internet is too big, too open, too free. There's just not enough people to monitor it. Instead, we have to work on the backside of this problem. We have to deal with identification of these threats as a society and dealing with them before something occurs. And we have to deal with the preparation for these threats happening, because the fact that they're going to happen is a reality.
And so if you see something, you have to say something.
Yeah, it's a saying that applies to more than just terrorism or child abuse or alcoholism. It applies to all of these situations.
Steve, we appreciate the time this morning. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Steve McMartin, professor of Madai University, former Homeland Security agent.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's going to go. Alvarez ties the game.
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.